Both dogs, didn't they?
Who are these goons? Thomas asks helplessly.
The police, the good guys. I then tell them the story of my client Sonny Worth, with the tank sitting in his den, and the lawsuit we won. I explain that a civil lawsuit is their only option right now. Their father will be indicted and prosecuted, and once the truth is finally learned, and I promise them that we will expose everything, there will be enormous pressure on the city to settle. Their end game is to keep their father out of jail. They can forget justice for what happened to their mother. A civil lawsuit, one put together by the right lawyer, of course, guarantees a safer flow of information. The cover-up is already underway, I say more than once. They're trying their best to listen, but they're in another world. Who could blame them? The meeting ends with both women in tears and Thomas unable to speak. It's time for me to back off. Chapter 5. Uninvited, though it's open to the public, I arrive at the large Methodist church just minutes before the service for Catherine Renfro. I find the stairs, climb up to the balcony, and sit in the semi-darkness. I am alone up here, but the rest of the sanctuary is packed. I look down on the crowd, all white, all middle class, all in disbelief that their friend got shot 7 times in her pajamas by the police. Aren't these senseless tragedies supposed to take place in other parts of town? These people are hardcore law and order. They vote to the right and want tough laws. If they think about SWAT teams at all, they think they're necessary to fight terror and drugs in other places. How could this happen to them? Absent from this ceremony is Doug Renfro. According to yesterday's Chronicle, he has just been indicted. He's still hospitalized, though recovering slowly. He begged the doctors and the police to allow him to attend his wife's funeral. The doctors said sure. The cops said no way. He's a threat to society. A cruel footnote to this tragedy is that Doug will live the rest of his life under the cloud of somehow being involved with drug trafficking. Most of these people will believe him and his denials, but for some there will be doubts. What was old Doug really up to? Surely he must have been guilty of something, or our brave police would not have gone after him. I suffer through the service along with everyone else. The air is thick with confusion and anger. The minister is comforting, but at times clearly unsure of what has happened. He tries to make some sense of it, but it's an impossible challenge. As he's wrapping things up, and as the crying gets louder, I ease down the stairs and exit through a side door. 2 hours later, my phone rings. It's Doug Renfro. Chapter 6. A lawyer like me is forced to work in the shadows. My opponents are protected by badges, uniforms, and all the myriad trappings of government power. They are sworn and duty-bound to uphold the law. But since they cheat like hell, it forces me to cheat even more. I have a network of contacts and sources. I can't call them friends because friendships require commitments. Nate Spurio is one example, an honest cop who wouldn't take a dime for inside information. I've offered. Another guy is a reporter with the Chronicle, and we swap gossip when it's convenient. No cash changes hands. One of my favorites is Oki Schwinn, and Oki always takes the money. Oki is a mid-level paper pusher in the federal court clerk's office in a downtown courthouse. He hates his job, despises his co-workers, and is always looking for an easy way to make a buck. He's also divorced, drinks too much, and constantly tests the boundaries of workplace sexual harassment. Oki's value is his ability to manipulate the court's random assignment of cases. When a civil lawsuit is filed, it is supposedly assigned by chance to one of our 6 federal judges. A computer does this, and the little procedure seems to work fine. There's always a judge you'd prefer, depending on the type of case and perhaps your history in various courtrooms, but who cares when it's completely random? Oki, though, knows how to rig the software and find the judge you really want.
He charges for this, handsomely, and he'll probably get caught, though he assures me there's no way. If he's caught, he'll get fired and maybe prosecuted, but Oki seems unconcerned by these possibilities. At his suggestion, we meet in a seedy strip club far from downtown. The crowd is staunchly blue-collar. The strippers are not worth describing. I turn my back to the stage so I don't have to look. Just under the roar, I say, "I'm filing suit tomorrow. Renfro, our SWAT boy's latest home invasion." He laughs and says,
"What a surprise. Let me guess. You think justice will be best served if the Honorable Arnie Sampson presides?" "My man. He's 110 years old, on senior status, half dead, and he says he's not taking cases anymore. Why can't we make these guys retire?" "That's between you and the Constitution. He'll take this one. The standard fee?" "Yep. But what if he says no and bounces it down the line?" "I'll have to take that chance."
I hand him an envelope with $3,000 in cash, his standard fee. He quickly shoves it into a pocket without even a thank you, then turns his attention to the girls. Chapter 7. At 9 the following morning, I walk into the clerk's office and file a $50 million lawsuit against the city, the police department, the police chief, and the 8 SWAT boys who attacked the Renfro's home 6 days earlier. Somewhere in the murky depths of the office, Oki does his magic, and the case is randomly and automatically assigned to Judge Arnold Sampson. I email a copy of the lawsuit to my friend at the Chronicle. I also file a request for a temporary restraining order to prevent the prosecutor from freezing Doug Renfro's assets. This is a favorite strong-arm tactic used by the government to harass criminal defendants. The original idea was to tie up assets supposedly accumulated in whatever criminal activity the defendant was engaged in, primarily drug trafficking. Seize the ill-gotten gains and make things tough for the cartels. And, like so many laws, it didn't take the prosecutors long to get creative and expand its use. In Doug's case, the government was prepared to argue that his assets, home, cars, bank, and retirement accounts, were accumulated in part with dirty money he earned while peddling ecstasy. Say what? By the time we have the emergency hearing on the temporary restraining order, the city prosecutors are backing down and looking for a way out. Judge Sampson, as feisty as ever, scolds them and even threatens them with contempt. We win round one. Round two is a bail hearing in state court, where the attempted murder charge is pending. With his assets free, I'm able to argue that Doug Renfro poses absolutely no flight risk and will show up in court whenever he's supposed to. His home is worth $400,000 with no mortgage, and I offer to post the deed as security. To my surprise, the judge agrees, and I walk my client out of court. We win round two, but these are the easy ones. 8 days after getting shot and losing his wife and both dogs, Doug Renfro returns home, where his 3 children, 7 grandchildren, and some friends are waiting. It will be a subdued homecoming. They graciously ask me to join them, but I decline. I fight tooth and nail for my clients and will break most laws to protect them, but I never get too close. Chapter 8. At 10 on a perfect Saturday morning, I'm sitting on a bench at a playground, waiting. It's a few blocks from my apartment, our usual meeting place. On the sidewalk, a beautiful woman approaches with a 7-year-old boy. He is my son. She is my ex-wife. The court order allows me to see him once a month for 36 hours. As he gets older, I will be entitled to more lenient visitation, but for now things are restricted. There are reasons for this, but I'd rather not discuss them now. Starcher does not smile when they get to the bench. I stand and peck Judith on the cheek, more for the kid's benefit than hers. She prefers not to touch. "Hey, buddy," I say, rubbing his head.
"Hey,"
he says, then walks over to a swing and climbs onto it. Judith sits beside me on the bench, and we watch him kick and begin swaying. "How's he doing?" I ask.
"Fine. His teachers are happy."
A long pause.
"I see you've been quite busy."
"Indeed. And you?"
"The usual grind."
"How's Ava?" I ask about her partner.
"She's great. What are your plans for the day?"
Judith does not like leaving our son with me. Once again, I've managed to offend the police, and this worries her. Worries me, too, but I would never admit it. I say, "I figure we'll do lunch, then there's a soccer game at the university this afternoon." She thinks a soccer game is safe enough. She says, "I'd like to have him back tonight, if that's okay." "I get 36 hours once a month, and that's too much?"
"No, Sebastian, it's not too much. I'm just worried, that's all."
Our fighting days are almost over, I hope. Take two lawyers with sharp elbows and even sharper tongues, give them an unwanted pregnancy, a nasty divorce with brutal aftershocks, and you have two people who can inflict serious damage. We're still scarred, so we don't fight much. "Fine," I say, in full retreat. Truthfully, there's nothing appealing about my apartment, and Starcher doesn't really like staying there, not yet anyway. He's too short to shoot pool on my vintage table, and I don't own any video games. Maybe when he's older. He's being raised by two women who freak out if another kid shoves him at school. I'm not sure I can toughen him up by popping into his life once a month, but I'm trying. Down the road, I suspect he'll get tired of living with a couple of edgy, intense women and want more time with his old man. My challenge is to remain relevant enough in his life to offer him that option.
"What time shall we meet?" she asks.
"Whenever."
"I'll meet you here at 6 p.m.,
she says as she gets to her feet and walks away. Starcher, his back to us, soars through the air and does not see her leave. It does not escape me that Judith did not bother to bring an overnight bag for the kid. She had no intention of allowing him to sleep at my place. I live on the 25th floor because I feel safer there. I routinely get death threats for a variety of reasons, and I've been honest with Judith about this. She is not wrong for wanting the kid at home, where things are probably calmer. Probably, but I don't know for sure. Just last month, Starcher told me his two mothers yell at each other all the time. For lunch, we go to my favorite pizza parlor, a place his mothers would never take him. The truth is, I don't care what he eats. In many ways, I'm more like a grandparent who spoils the kids before sending them back home. If he wants Ben and Jerry's before and after lunch, so be it. As we eat, he comes to life while I quiz him about school. He's in the second grade in a public school not far from where I grew up. Judith insisted he attend some crunchy little granola academy where all plastic is forbidden and all the teachers wear thick wool socks and old sandals. At $40,000 a year, I said, hell no. She ran back to court, and for once the judge sided with me. So, Starcher is in a normal school with kids of all colors and a seriously cute teacher, recently divorced. As I've said, Starcher was a mistake. Judith and I were in the process of ending our chaotic relationship when she somehow got pregnant. The split grew even more complicated. I moved out and she assumed total possession of him. I was stiff-armed at every point, though, to be honest, I have never clamored to be a father. He's all hers, at least in her opinion, so it's becoming hilarious to watch him grow into a little boy who looks exactly like me. My mother found my second-grade school photo. At 7, we could pass for identical twins. We talk about fighting, the schoolyard variety. I ask him if he sees fights during recess, and he says,
"Occasionally."
He tells me the story of the day when kids began yelling, "Fight! Fight!" and everyone ran over to watch. Two third-graders, one black and one white, were on the ground kicking and squirming, biting and clawing and swapping punches, while the crowd yelled encouragement. "Was it fun to watch?" I ask. He smiles and says,
"Sure, it was cool."
"What happened?" The teachers came and got them and took them into the office. I think they got in trouble.
I'm sure they did. Has your mother ever talked to you about fighting? He shakes his head. No. Okay, here are the rules. Fighting is bad and will only get you in trouble, so don't fight. Never start a fight. But if someone else hits you, or pushes you, or trips you, or if two guys jump on a friend of yours, then sometimes you have to fight. Never back down when the other guy starts a fight. And when you fight, never, never, never give up.
Did you get into fights?
All the time. I was never a bully, and I never started a fight. And I didn't like to fight. But if the other guy pushed me around, then I hit him back.
Did you get in trouble?
I did. I took my punishment.
What does that mean?
Means the teacher yelled at me and my mother yelled at me and maybe they kicked me out of school for half a day or something like that. Again, Bud, fighting is wrong.
Why do you always call me Bud?
Because I loathe the name your mother chose for you. Just a nickname, that's all.
Mom says you don't like my name.
Not true, Bud. Judith will always be at war over the soul of her son. She cannot rise above the temptation of the silliest cheap shot. Why on earth would one parent tell a 7-year-old that the other parent doesn't like his name? I'm sure I'd be shocked at the other crap she's told him. Partner has the day off, so I drive my van to the soccer stadium on campus. Starcher thinks the van is cool, with its sofa, swivel chairs, small desk, and television. He's not sure why I use it as an office, and I have not gone into details about the bulletproof windows and automatic pistol in the console. It's a women's soccer game, not that it matters to me. I don't follow the sport, so if I'm forced to watch it, I'd rather see girls in shorts than guys with hairy legs. Starcher, though, loves the excitement. His mothers do not believe in team sports, so he's just been signed up for tennis lessons. Nothing wrong with tennis, but if he gets my moves, he won't last long. I always liked to hit. In youth basketball, I was the kid with 4 fouls by halftime. Always more fouls than points. In Pop Warner football, I played linebacker because I loved the contact. After an hour, someone finally scores. But by then I'm thinking about the Renfro case, and any interest I had in the game is gone. Starcher and I share a popcorn and talk about this and that. The truth is, I'm so far detached from his little world that I can't sustain a decent conversation. I'm such a pathetic father. Chapter 9. Sanity slowly arrives in the Renfro disaster. Under pressure from all sides, but especially from my pal at the Chronicle, the city flounders with its response. The chief of police has gone mum, claiming he can't comment because of pending litigation. The mayor is running for cover, obviously trying to create some distance. Hot on his ass are his enemies, some city councilmen who enjoy the grandstanding and would like to have his job. They are in a minority, though, because no one really wants trouble with the police department. Sadly, dissent nowadays is considered unpatriotic, and in our post-9/11 atmosphere, any criticism of those in uniform, any uniform, is stifled. Being labeled soft on crime or soft on terror is a politician's curse. I'm feeding everything to my pal at the newspaper. Citing unnamed sources, he's having a ball hammering away at the cops and their tactics, screw-ups, and attempts to cover up. Using materials from my files, he runs a lengthy piece about the history of botched invasions and excessive force. I'm getting as much press as I can possibly generate. I cannot lie and say I don't love this. Indeed, I live for it. The defendants file a motion with Judge Sampson and ask him to, in effect, put a muzzle on all lawyers involved in the civil lawsuit. Judge Sampson denies the motion without even the benefit of a hearing. Right now, the attorneys for the city are terrified of the judge and running for cover. I'm firing as many bullets as possible. I practice alone, without a real office, and certainly without a real staff. It's extremely difficult for a lone gunman like me to engage in high-powered civil and criminal litigation without some support, which is where the two Harrys come in. Harry Gross and Harry Skolnick run a 15-lawyer shop in a converted warehouse downtown by the river. They do mostly appellate work and try to avoid jury trials, and thus spend their hours buried in books and pushing legal pads and briefs around their desks. Our arrangement is simple. They do my research and paperwork, and I give them 1/3 of the fees. This allows them to play it safe, to keep some distance from me, my clients, and the people I tend to irritate. They will prepare a stack of motions an inch thick, hand it to me for my review and signature, and nothing can be traced back to them. They toil away behind locked doors and never worry about the police. In the case of Sonny Worth, the client who woke up with the tank roaring into his den, the city settled for $1 million. My cut was 25%. The two Harrys got a nice check and everybody was happy, except for Sonny. In this state, all damages in civil cases are capped at $1 million. This is because the wise people who make the laws in our state legislature decided 10 years ago that their judgment was far superior to that of the actual jurors who hear the evidence and evaluate the damages. They, the lawmakers, were hoodwinked by the insurance companies who are still funding the national tort reform movement, a political crusade that has been wildly successful. Virtually every state has fallen in line with caps on damages and other laws designed to keep folks away from the courthouse. So far, no one has seen a decline in insurance rates. An investigative report by my pal at the Chronicle revealed that 90% of our legislators took campaign money from the insurance industry. And this is considered a democracy. Every street lawyer in this state can tell you a horror story of a badly maimed and permanently injured client who, after medical expenses, got almost nothing. Not long after slamming the courthouse doors, these same wise and courageous legislators passed another law that prohibits homeowners from firing upon cops who invade their homes, regardless of whether the cops have the right home or not. So when Doug Renfro hit the floor and began firing his pistol, he was violating the law, with no real defense. What about the real criminals? Well, our legislators passed yet another law that grants criminal immunity to SWAT teams who get a bit carried away and shoot the wrong person. In the Renfro disaster, 4 cops fired at least 38 rounds. It's not clear who actually shot Doug and his wife, and it doesn't matter. They are all immune from criminal prosecution. I spend hours with Doug trying to explain these legal principles, none of which makes sense. He wants to know why his wife's life is worth only $1 million. I explain that his state senator voted for this cap on damages, and that he also takes money from insurance lobbyists, so perhaps Doug should contact this elected official and bitch about the way he votes. Doug asks, "Then why did we sue for $50 million when the most we can get is only $1 million? Another question with a long answer. First, it's called making a statement. We're angry and fighting back, and suing for $50 million sounds much more aggressive than a mere $1 million. Second, a quirk in this already screwed-up law prohibits the jurors from knowing about the $1 million cap. They can sit through a month of testimony, evaluate the evidence, deliberate thoughtfully, and return a proper verdict of, say, $5 to $10 million. Then they go home, and the next day the judge quietly reduces the verdict down to the cap. The newspaper might trumpet another big verdict, but the lawyers and judges, and insurance companies, know the truth. It makes no sense. But bear in mind, this law was written by the same conspirators who insert endless gibberish into your insurance policies. Doug asks, "But how can a cop kick in my door and shoot me with immunity, but if I return fire, I'm a criminal looking at 20 years? The simple answer is because they are cops. The complicated answer is that our lawmakers often pass laws that are not fair. My client is still in mourning, but some of the shock and grief are beginning to subside. His thinking is getting clearer. Reality
is setting in. His wife is gone, murdered by men who will not be held accountable. Her life is worth only $1 million. And he, Mr. Doug Renfro, is in the midst of a criminal prosecution that will one day drag him into a courtroom where his only hope will be a hung jury. The road to justice is filled with barriers and landmines, most of them created by men and women who claim to be seeking justice. Chapter 10. My little cage fighter, Tadeo Zapata, has won his last 4 fights, all by brutal knockouts. That's 11 in a row, with only 3 career losses, all on points. He's now 32nd in the world bantamweight rankings and moving up nicely. UFC promoters are taking notice. There's talk of a fight in Vegas in 6 months if he keeps winning. Oscar, his trainer, and Norberto, his manager, tell me they can't keep the kid out of the gym. He is focused, hungry, almost manic in his quest for a title fight. They work him hard and are convinced he can be a top 5 contender. Tonight he fights a tough black kid with the stage name of Crush. I've seen Crush fight twice, and he doesn't worry me. He's just a brawler, a street fighter with limited training in mixed martial arts. In both fights he got knocked out late in the 3rd round because of fatigue. He starts with a bang, cannot pace himself, and pays for it at the end. I wake up with a bad case of butterflies, thinking of nothing but the fight, and cannot eat breakfast. I'm puttering around the apartment late in the afternoon when Judith calls my cell. There's an emergency. Her college roommate has been seriously injured in an auto accident in Chicago. Judith is racing to the airport. Ava, her partner, is out of town, so it's up to me to man up and be a father. I bite my tongue and do not tell her that I have plans. It's fight night. We meet at the park and she delivers our son, his duffel bag, and a barrage of warnings and instructions. Normally, I'd snap back and we'd argue, but Starcher seems to be in good spirits and eager to get away from her. I've never met her college roommate, so I don't inquire. She storms off, jumps in her car, and disappears. Over pizza, I ask Starcher if he's ever seen a cage fight on television. Of course not. His mothers monitor everything he reads, watches, eats, drinks, and thinks. Last month, though, he spent the night with a friend, Tony, who has a big brother named Zach, and late that night, Zach pulled out a laptop and they watched all manner of evil, including an ultimate fight. I ask, "How was it?" "Pretty cool," he says with a grin. "You're not mad?" "Of course not. I love those fights." I go on to explain how our night will go. The kid's face lights up like I've never seen. I make him swear that he will not, under any circumstances, tell his mothers about going to the fights. I explain that I have no choice, that I have to be there as part of a team, and that under normal circumstances he would not be invited. "Let me handle your mother," I say, without much confidence, but then I realize he will be grilled mercilessly about the evening. Let's just say we had pizza and watched TV in my apartment, which will be the truth because we're eating pizza now and we'll turn on the television when we get to my apartment. For a second he looks confused, then lights up again. Back at my apartment, he watches a cartoon while I change clothes. He likes my shiny yellow jacket with Tadeo Zapata emblazoned across the back, and it takes me a while to explain that I work the corner. Each fighter has a corner team to help him between rounds, and, well, I'm in charge of water and anything else that Tadeo might need. No, I'm not really that necessary, but it sure is a lot of fun. Partner picks us up in the black van, and we ride to the city auditorium. For the next 2 hours, Partner will do the babysitting, a new role for him. Driver, bodyguard, errand boy, investigator, confidant, strategist, and now this. He doesn't mind. I pull some strings and get them 2 seats on the floor, 6 rows back from the cage. Once they are situated with popcorn and sodas, I tell Starcher that I have to go check on my fighter. He's excited, wide-eyed, chattering away to Partner, who's already his best friend. Though I know the kid is safe, I'm still worried. Worried that his mother will find out and sue me again for neglect, corruption of a minor, and anything else she can possibly throw at me. Worried also that with this crowd, anything can happen. I watch a lot of fights and have often thought that it's safer inside the ring than out in the crowd. The fans are drinking and rowdy, and they want blood. A city councilwoman in some place like Wichita tried to pass an ordinance that would prohibit anyone under the age of 18 from being admitted to a cage fight. It failed, but there is some wisdom behind it. Since there's no such law in our city, young Starcher Whitley has a ringside seat. Zapata versus Crush is the main event, which is fantastic, of course, right where we want to be, but it requires a long wait through the undercard. Tonight there are 5 warm-ups, so the evening will move painfully slowly. I check in with Team Zapata, and everyone is in good spirits. Subdued, as always, but quite confident. Tadeo is still in street clothes, lying on a table with his headphones on. His brother Miguel says he's ready. Oscar whispers that it will be a first-round knockout. I hang around for a few minutes, but can't stand the tension. I leave and walk through a tunnel to a lower level where my little gang of criminals is waiting in a supply room. Slide, the convicted murderer, has been losing lately and has cut back on his wagers. Nino, the meth dealer, has, as always, a pocketful of cash and is splashing it around. DiNardo, the mafia wannabe, doesn't like any of the fights. Johnny is absent. Frankie, the old guy and our scorekeeper, is nursing a double scotch, probably not his first. We work through the undercard and place our bets. As usual, no one will bet against my man. I chide them, taunt them, curse them. But they don't budge. I offer $10,000 for a first-round knockout, but get no takers. Frustrated, I leave with only $5,000 on the table, a grand for each bout on the undercard. I pay $8 for a watered-down beer and climb to the nosebleed section, which is packed. A sellout, standing room only. Tadeo is becoming a big draw in his hometown, and I hammered the promoter for a guaranteed purse. $8,000, win, lose, or draw. I lean on a steel beam above the top row and watch the first fight. I can barely see my kid in the crowd, way down there. I lose my bets on the first 4 fights, win the 5th, then hustle to the dressing room. Team Zapata crowds around its hero, who also wears bright yellow. We look like a sack of organic lemons. We walk him through the tunnel and into the lights, and the crowd goes wild. I wave at Starcher, and he waves back with a huge smile on his face. Round 1. 3 minutes of boredom as Crush, to our surprise, does not charge across the ring like a mad dog. Instead, he plays defense and escapes serious damage. Using a left jab that at times is hard to see, Tadeo opens a cut over Crush's right eye. Late in the round, Crush returns the favor with a nasty gash across Tadeo's forehead. Oscar manages to close it between rounds. Cuts are not that critical in cage fighting because the fights are so short. In boxing, a first-round cut is terrifying because it becomes a target for the next half hour. Round 2. They hit the deck and grapple for the first half of the round. Crush has a strong upper body and Tadeo is unable to pin him. Boos can be heard. Back on their feet, they spar and kick with neither scoring much. Just before the bell, Tadeo lands a hard right to the jaw that would have flattened any of the last dozen or so men he's faced, but Crush stays on his feet. As Tadeo goes in for the kill, Crush manages to grab his waist and hang on until the bell. Suddenly, I don't like this fight. Tadeo is clearly ahead on points, but I don't trust judges. Perhaps it's the nature of my profession. I like knockouts, not decisions. Round 3. Having paced himself, Crush figures he's got some gas in the tank. He charges across the ring and surprises everyone with a wild flurry that ignites the crowd. It's certainly exciting, but not damaging. Tadeo covers well, then lands a couple of hard jabs that draw more blood. Crush charges again and again. Tadeo, the boxer, picks his openings and shoots jabs that land beautifully. I'm screaming. The crowd is screaming. The floor seems to be shaking. Meanwhile, the clock is ticking and Crush is still out there, charging and charging, his face a bloody mess. He lands a wild right and Tadeo goes down, but only for a second. Crush leaps on top of him and they kick and claw and finally manage to untangle. Tadeo has not gone this late in a fight in a long time and he begins to press. Crush charges again, and for the final minute, they go toe-to-toe in the center of the ring, just two mad dogs beating the crap out of each other. My heart is pounding, my stomach is rolling, and I'm just the water boy. We assure Tadeo he's won again as we wait and wait. Finally, the referee walks the fighters to the center of the ring. The announcer proclaims a split decision, with Crush winning by a point. A thunderous wave of booing and screaming rocks the auditorium. Tadeo is stunned, shocked, his mouth wide open, his swollen eyes filled with hate. The fans are throwing things at the cage, and we're on the verge of a riot. The next 15 seconds will change Tadeo's life forever. He suddenly whirls and throws a hard right into the left side of Crush's face. It's a sucker punch, a vicious one that Crush never saw coming. He crumples to the mat, out cold. Instantly, Tadeo attacks the referee, who's also black, and pummels him with a flurry. The ref stumbles and lands against the cage, half sitting up, and Tadeo pounces on him with a furious barrage of punches. For a few seconds, everyone is too stunned to react. They are, after all, in a cage, and it takes time to mount a rescue. By the time Norberto tackles Tadeo, the poor ref is unconscious. The auditorium erupts as fights break out everywhere. Tadeo's fans, most of them Hispanic, and Crush's fans, most of whom are black and heavily outnumbered, attack each other like gangs in the street. Cups of beer and cartons of popcorn rain down like confetti. A security guard nearby gets hit over the head with a folding chair. It's total chaos, and no one is safe. I forget about the carnage inside the cage and sprint for my son. He's not in his seat, but through the melee I see the hulking figure of partner as they make their escape. I go after them, and within seconds, we are safe. As we duck out of the auditorium, we pass panicked police running toward the action. In the van, I clutch Starcher in the front seat as partner takes the side streets. I say, "Are you okay, bud?" He says, "Let's do it again." Minutes later, we enter my apartment and take a deep breath. I get drinks, beers for partner and me, and a soda for Starcher, and we turn on the local news. The story is still unfolding, and the reporters are frantic. The kid is excited and talks enough to let me know he's not traumatized. I try in vain to explain what happened. Partner sleeps on the sofa. I wake him at 4 a.m. to talk strategy. He leaves for the city jail to try and find Tadeo, and for the hospital to dig for information about the referee. I can't shake the image of Tadeo pounding the guy's face. He was knocked cold from the first punch, and there were dozens afterward, all delivered by a man completely out of his mind. I try not to think about what's next for my fighter. I grind beans, and while the coffee is brewing, I go online to check the news. Fortunately, no one has died yet, but at least 20 people are in the hospital. Rescue personnel are still on the scene, and the blame is being heaped upon one Tadeo Zapata, age 22, an up-and-coming cage fighter who's now locked away in the city jail. Judith calls at 6:30 to check on her son. She's hours away and knows nothing about the riot we survived. I ask about her college roommate. She is surviving, but things look bad. Judith will be home tomorrow, Sunday, and I assure her the kid will be just fine. All is well. With some luck, she'll never know. Luck, though, is not going my way. A few minutes after our brief chat, I checked the Chronicle online. The late edition managed to catch the breaking story down at the old auditorium, and on the front page is a rather large color photo of two people racing toward an exit. One is partner, and he's holding a kid. Starcher seems to be staring at the photographer, as if posing for the shot. Their names are not given, there was no time to ask,
but to those who know him, his identity is indisputable. How long before one of Judith's friends sees the photo and gives her a call? How long before she opens her laptop and sees for herself? While I wait, I turn on the television and go to SportsCenter. The story is irresistible because it's all right there, on video, blow by blow by blow. I get sick watching it again and again. Partner calls from the hospital with the news that the referee, a guy named Sean King, is still in surgery. It's no surprise that Partner is not the only person sniffing around the corridors waiting for any bit of news. He's heard of massive head wounds, but has no details. He's already been to the jail, where a contact confirmed that Mr. Zapata is safely locked away and not receiving visitors. At 8 a.m., our blundering chief of police decides the world should hear from him. He arranges a press conference, one of those little muscle pageants in which a thick wall of uniformed white men line up behind the chief and scowl at the reporters while acting as though they really don't want to be seen. For 30 minutes, the chief talks and answers questions and reveals not a single fact that wasn't posted online 2 hours earlier. He's obviously enjoying the moment because nothing can be blamed on him or his men. Just as I'm getting bored, Judith calls. The conversation is predictable, tense, bitchy, and accusatory. She's seen the front page photo of her son escaping the melee, and she wants answers, and now, damn it. I assure her our son is sleeping soundly and probably dreaming of a fine day with his father. She says she's catching an early flight and will be in the city by 5 p.m., which is the precise moment I'm supposed to meet her in the park and hand him over. She'll file papers first thing Monday morning to terminate all visitation rights. File away, I say, because it won't work. No judge in town will totally exclude me from seeing my son once a month. And who knows, maybe the judge we draw is a fan of cage fighting. She curses and I curse back and we finally get off the phone. Looks like we've just begun to fight. Chapter 11. The Sunday papers rage against cage fighting, with knee-jerk condemnations coming from all directions. The internet burns with the story. A YouTube video of the attack on the referee has 4 million hits before noon, and Tadeo has instantly become the most famous cage fighter in the world, though he will never fight again. Slowly, the wounded are released from hospitals, and, fortunately, there were no serious injuries to the fans. Just a bunch of drunks throwing punches and launching chairs. Sean King remains in a coma, in serious condition. Crush is resting comfortably with a badly fractured jaw and a concussion. Late in the afternoon, I am allowed to visit my client in one of the jail's attorney rooms. He's sitting on the other side of a thick metal screen when I walk in and take a seat. His face is cut and badly swollen from the fight, but that's the least of his problems. He is so subdued, I wonder if he's been drugged. We chat for a moment. "When can I get out of here?" he asks. "You'd better get used to it," I want to say. "Your first appearance is in the morning, in court. I'll be there. Nothing much will happen. They'll wait to see what happens with the referee. If he dies, then you're really up shit creek. If he recovers, they'll charge you with a bunch of stuff, but it won't be murder. Maybe in a week or so we'll go back to court and request a reasonable bond. I can't guess what the judge will do, so to answer your question, there's a chance you might bond out in a few days. There's an even better chance you'll stay in jail until a trial."
"How long will that take?"
"A trial?"
"Yes."
"Hard to say. 6 months at the earliest, probably more like a year. The trial itself won't last very long because there won't be many witnesses. They'll just roll the video." He looks down as if he wants to cry. "I love this kid, but there's not much I can do for him, now or in 6 months." "Do you remember it?" I ask. Slowly he begins to nod. He says,
"I just snapped. They cheated me out of a clear win. The ref made me fight his way, not mine. The ref kept getting in the way, you know, man? I just couldn't fight my fight. I mean, I didn't want to hurt the ref, but I just snapped. I was so angry, so destroyed when he raised that guy's hand. I kicked his ass, didn't I?
Crush or the referee?
Come on, man. Crush. I kicked his ass, right?
No, you did not. But you won the fight. I saw every second of the fight, and I never felt as though the ref was in the way. As far as legal defenses go, I don't think much of this one. The ref held me back, cost me the match, so I caved in his face. It was justified.
They took it away from me, he says.
The referee is not a judge, Tadeo. The three judges did the scoring.
You went after the wrong guy.
He picks at the stitches in his forehead and says,
I know, I know. I did wrong, Sebastian. But you gotta do something, okay?
You know I'll do everything possible.
Will I serve some time?
You're serving it now. Get used to it. I've already played with the numbers. If Sean King dies, I'm thinking 20 years for second-degree murder, maybe 15 for manslaughter. If he lives, 3 to 5 for aggravated assault. Since I'm not ready to share these thoughts, I punt by saying, let's worry about that later.
Probably so, right?
Probably so. There is a gap in the conversation as we hear doors clanging in the background. A jailer yells an obscenity. A tear emerges through Tadeo's swollen left eye and runs down his bruised cheek.
I can't believe it, man. I just can't believe it.
His voice is soft and pained. If you can't believe it, think about that poor ref and his family. I need to run, Tadeo. I'll see you in the morning in court.
I gotta wear this in court?
He asks, tugging at his orange jumpsuit.
Afraid so.
It's just a first appearance. Chapter 12. At 9 o'clock on Monday morning, I'm in a busy courtroom with a bunch of other defense lawyers and prosecutors. In one corner, there is a collection of shady-looking men in orange jumpsuits, all handcuffed together and watched by armed bailiffs. These are the new arrestees, and this is their second stop on the judicial assembly line, the first stop being the jail. One by one, their names are called, and after being uncuffed, they saunter over to a spot in front of the bench, upon which sits a judge, one of 20 in our system, who handles the preliminary matters. The judge asks them some questions, the most important being, "Do you have a lawyer?" Very few of them do, and the judge then assigns them to the public defender's office. A rookie will pop up, stand beside his new client, and tell him not to say anything else. Dates will be set for return visits. Tadeo Zapata, though, has a lawyer. They call his name and we meet in front of the bench. His face looks even worse. Most of the hushed conversations stop when the crowd realizes this is the guy everyone is talking about, the promising mixed martial arts fighter who is now the YouTube star.
Are you Tadeo Zapata? The judge asks with interest, the first time this morning he's seemed engaged.
Yes, sir.
And I assume Mr. Sebastian Rudd is your lawyer?
Yes, sir.
An assistant prosecutor eases behind him. The judge continues.
You are charged at this point with aggravated assault. Do you understand this?
Yes, sir.
Mr. Rudd, have you explained to your client that the charges might change to something more serious?
Yes, sir, he understands.
By the way, what is the latest on the referee? He asks the assistant prosecutor, as if the guy were the treating physician.
Last I heard, Mr. King's condition is still critical.
Very well, His Honor says. Let's meet back here in a week and see where things stand. Until then, Mr. Rudd, we won't discuss the matter of bail.
Sure, Judge, I say.
We are dismissed. As Tadeo walks away, I whisper,
I'll see you at the jail tomorrow.
Thanks,
he says, then looks at the spectators and nods at his mother, who's sitting with an entire pack of crying relatives. She emigrated from El Salvador 25 years ago, has her green card, works a late shift in a cafeteria, and is raising a flock of children, grandchildren, and other assorted relatives. Tadeo and his cage skills were her ticket to a better life.
Miguel holds her hand and whispers in Spanish. He's been chewed up by our judicial system a few times and knows the score. I speak to them briefly, assure them I'm doing whatever can be done, then walk with them out of the courtroom and into a hallway where some reporters are waiting, two with cameras. This is what I live for. Chapter 13. Quite the busy morning. While I'm in court with Tadeo, Judith does exactly as she promised and files a nasty motion to terminate all of my visitation rights, even the 3 hours I get on Christmas Eve and the 2 hours on my son's birthday. She claims I'm an unfit parent, a danger to his physical safety, and a horrible influence on the child's life. She demands an expedited hearing. Such theatrics, as if the kid were in danger. Harry and Harry prepare a vicious response, and I file it Monday afternoon. Once again, we square off in her ongoing crusade to teach me valuable lessons. No judge will grant her demands, and she knows it. But she's doing it because she's angry, and she thinks that if she drags me through the meat grinder once more, I'll finally surrender and get out of their lives. I'm almost looking forward to the hearing. First, though, we have another problem. On Wednesday, she calls my cell around noon and announces rudely, "We have a meeting at school this afternoon." Oh, really? This is maybe the second time I've been asked to show up at the school and act like a parent. Until now, Judith has done a fine job of keeping me out of our son's business. I ask, "Okay, what's up?"
"Starcher is in trouble. He got in a fight at school, punched another kid."
I am overwhelmed with fatherly pride, and I almost laugh. But I bite my tongue and say, "Oh, gosh, what happened?" I want to add questions such as, "Did he win? How many times did he punch him? And was the other kid a third grader?" But I manage to control my excitement.
"That's what the meeting is all about. I'll see you in the principal's office at 4.
"For today?"
"Yes," she says, bitchy and firm.
"Okay. I'll have to move a court appearance, but it's no problem. I wouldn't miss this meeting for the world. My kid, a soft little boy who's never had a chance to be tough, punched somebody." I smile all the way to the school. The principal has a big office with several chairs around a coffee table. We meet there, very casual. Her name is Doris, a frazzled veteran of at least 40 years in public education, but she has an easy smile and a comforting voice. Who knows how many meetings like this she's suffered through? Judith and Ava are already there when I arrive. I nod at them without speaking. Judith is wearing a designer dress and is stunning. Ava, the former lingerie model, is wearing super-tight leather pants and a tight blouse. She may have the brains of a gerbil, but she still has a body that belongs on magazine covers. Both women look fabulous, and it's obvious, at least to me, that they spent some time dressing up for this occasion. But why? Then Ms. Tarrant arrives, and things become clearer. She's Starcher's teacher, a 33-year-old knockout who got a divorce recently and, according to a source, is already back in the game. She has short blonde hair, cut smartly, and large brown eyes that force everyone she meets to do at least one double take. Judith and Ava are no longer the hottest babes in the room. In fact, they're getting smoked. I stand and make a fuss over Ms. Tarrant, who enjoys the attention. Judith immediately goes into total bitch mode. She's halfway there by nature. But Ava's eyes sort of linger when she looks at the teacher. Mine are lingering like crazy. Doris gives us the basics. During recess yesterday afternoon, some second-grade boys were playing kickball on the playground. There were words, then a scuffle, then a boy named Brad pushed Starcher, who then smacked Brad on the mouth. It caused a slight cut, thus blood, thus it's a major incident. Not surprisingly, the boys clammed up when the teachers arrived and haven't said much. I blurt out, "Sounds pretty harmless, just boys being boys." None of the four women agree, not that I expect them to. Ms. Tarrant says,
"One of the boys told me that Brad was making fun of Starcher because his picture was in the newspaper."
"Who threw the first punch?" I ask, almost rudely. they squirm and don't like the question.
Does that really matter? Judith shoots back.
Damn right it does.
Sensing trouble, Doris rushes in with, We have strict rules against fighting, Mr. Rudd, regardless of who starts the altercation. Our students are taught not to engage in this type of activity.
I get that, but you can't expect a kid to get bullied without standing up for himself.
The word bullied is a hot one. With my kid now the victim, they're not sure how to respond.
Miss Tarrant says,
Well, I'm not sure he was being bullied.
Is Brad a bad apple? I ask the teacher.
No, he certainly is not. I have a great group of kids this year.
Sure you do, including mine.
These are little boys, okay? They can't hurt each other, so they push and shove on the playground.
They are boys, damn it! Let them be boys!
Don't punish them every time they disagree.
We're teaching them lessons, Mr. Rudd, Doris says piously.
Judith snarls. Have you talked to him about fighting?
Yes, I have. I've told him that fighting is wrong. Never start a fight. But if someone else happens to start one, then by all means protect himself.
And what exactly is wrong with that?
None of the four take a crack at answering this, so I shove on.
You'd better teach him now to stand up for himself, or he'll get bullied for the rest of his life. These are kids. They'll fight. They'll win some, lose some, but they'll outgrow it. Believe me, when a boy gets older and gets punched a few times, he loses his enthusiasm for fighting.
For the second time, I catch Ava glancing at Miss Tarrant's legs.
I'm glancing too. Can't help it.
They deserve a lot.